We'll hear argument now in the case of Christensen against Boone County.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mark Bird, and I represent the appellants in this case, Anita Christensen and Robert Alpe. We're here seeking reversal of the district court's grant of the defendant's 12B6 motion to dismiss, which dismissed three substantive counts in the plaintiff's amended complaint. In furtherance of our seeking that reversal, I'll be fostering three arguments this morning. Essentially, those mirror the three counts that were dismissed by the district court. This action was brought pursuant to 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. Count one was brought against the municipality, Boone County, under a theory that the sheriff's department, in this case, failed to adequately train, monitor, supervise, and discipline one of their sheriff's deputies, who's an individual defendant in the case, Edward Krieger. The second count is a count under Section 1983 for violation and deprivation of civil rights under color of state law with respect to the plaintiffs and appellants' liberty interests, their rights to be free from unwarranted searches and seizures, and their right to freedom of association under the First, Fourth, Fifth, and Fourteenth Amendments. And finally, count three, which was dismissed, was a pendant state law claim under Illinois law for intentional infliction of emotional distress. All three of these counts revolve around the same pattern of conduct, and I will begin by addressing the first count, which is the count against the municipal actor here, the County of Boone. What's important to keep in mind is that all of the misconduct alleged in plaintiff's amended complaint derives out of the actions of a sheriff's deputy in Boone County, Defendant Krieger.
Exactly. And since you don't allege that it is the policy of Boone County to harass police officers with or without living girlfriends, one would think that under Monell, your claim is limited to the personal state actors.
Except, Your Honor, case law has also dictated that if municipal inaction in the face of repeated instances where these acts of misconduct were reported are left unignored, they can reach the point where they are actually a legal cause. The inaction can only embolden.
I don't understand that, I must say. I mean, it sounds like that's just disagreement with DeShaney. And DeShaney holds that there is no obligation to, on the state's behalf, to protect private parties from misconduct.
DeShaney, however, Your Honor, I believe dealt
no
with...
No obligation to prosecute, there's no obligation to protect, it's just not there.
That's correct, Your Honor, but my reading of that is that we're discussing an individual who is a private citizen engaging in the misconduct, and I agree that there is no general duty to protect. However, DeShaney also notes in that line of cases also note that the municipal actor can be held liable if, in fact, they make matters worse or their action or inaction is a cause and fact of the conduct or the misconduct complained of. Unlike the situation
no,
where there's
that was the whole point of DeShaney. There was no doubt that the state actor had played a link in the causal chain. That was the basis of the claim.
But
the Supreme Court held it legally deficient, not factually deficient.
But, Your Honor, I believe that in that situation, the action or an inaction on the part of
if
the
I
municipality...
Were you, time is short. If I were you, I would devote it to the individual defendant and not to Boone County.
All right. My only point on the first issue, then, is that it was a municipal actor, was reported over a dozen times in some way, shape, or form, and nothing was done. But more importantly, then, with respect to the second argument, it's our position that The district court erred in dismissing this claim on a motion to dismiss prior to being able to take any discovery in the case whatsoever, and that matter should be reversed and remanded. The action in this case had
Is there any contention that this action was taken because of the fact that the plaintiffs are living together?
Your Honor, the only link with respect to the plaintiff Christensen engaging in a but-for analysis, I believe that the record would demonstrate that but for her relationship with plaintiff Alty, she would not be involved in this situation.
No, that's not the question I'm asking. Is there any claim that the individual defendant is harassing Alty because he is living with Christensen?
No, sir. There is no such allegation.
Well, then, suppose a postal truck were to run down Alty on the street, right, cause him injury, as a result of which Christensen might bring a claim for loss of consortium. Would that be a constitutional tort? Because obviously if he's in the hospital, he's not enjoying relations with his girlfriend.
No, Your Honor, primarily because that would not constitute an intentional tort committed by a state actor.
Well,
against
I would think it would be because it wasn't done because of this relationship. It was just a collateral consequence of other activity.
Under the circumstances, right. Your Honor.
Under the Supreme Court standard in Personnel Administrator of Massachusetts against Feeney, this difference between what you do because of something and what you do with utter indifference to it is very important to constitutional analysis.
And I think
you're not alleging, as you've just told me, you're not alleging, and I didn't see it in your brief, you're not alleging that any of this was done because of the relation between Alty and Christensen.
No, in fact, Your
Honor.
It's
very difficult to see where we go.
The motivation we allege stems from an arrest that occurred prior in general bad blood between.
Exactly. So any effect on the relation between Alty and Christensen is just a side effect. It's a collateral consequence, and by your own allegation, not something that was desired by the defendant.
But unlike Your Honor's scenario, this is a situation where the defendant Krieger's intentional actions are directed at Ms. Christensen solely because of her relationship with the defendant Alty. Perhaps not solely, there are other motivations as well, but we've alleged, and I believe at this stage needs to be taken as true, that it was because of her involvement with him that his action was directed at her in the first place. There's a difference between an incidental effect of an action like Your Honor's hypothetical with the postal carrier and a situation where the plaintiff is sought out by the defendant and with intent is...
I don't see why. Suppose, think of Paul against Davis, which holds that defamation is not actionable under the Constitution. Let's assume the plaintiff in Paul against Davis had alleged, after I was defamed by being labeled a common shoplifter, this made my family life miserable. My wife didn't like me. My kids were scoffed at in school. Would that allegation alter the outcome of Paul against Davis?
I think it would, Your Honor, to the extent that in that situation, the wife and the family...
I don't think the Supreme Court viewed its decision in Paul against Davis as a pleading rule or as applicable only to single plaintiffs as opposed to married ones.
Perhaps, but Your Honor, the whole line of cases flowing from Roberts versus United States JCs sets up a continuum of associational protection that on one end there's very slight protection for common association, and on the other end there is the most intimate associational relationships such as marriage, child rearing, that, and even the district court in this case recognized that under the paramour relationship, this is entitled to a stricter form of scrutiny. I would argue respectfully that the balance should fall much closer to the familial, intimate personal relationships.
Mr. Byrd, is your argument before us really exclusively focused on the interference with the relationship of these individuals?
No, sir, Your Honor. It also is directed at the inherent liberty interest that is at the core of the First, Fourth, and Fourteenth Amendments.
Well, I see that in your complaint, but I didn't see much of that in your appellate brief. I mean, your argument seems to have morphed into an argument that focuses on the relationship. That's why I ask.
Except that the whole analysis under Roberts versus United States JCs is directed more at the associational aspect. And in fact, the quote that is cited in brief from Roberts indicates that it's this type of protected relationship, this intimate type of relationship, that is fundamental to a concept of ordered liberty. And with respect to the Fourth Amendment analysis, there was never an actual search. There was never an actual seizure. It is behavior that's been considered to be tantamount to stalking, as alleged in the complaint and in the supplementation from Ms. Christensen's employer, which was a letter directed to the Sheriff's Department. And we cited to the case of Benigni, where the Ninth Circuit has held that even lawful conduct, lawful searches can be done in a manner that takes it out of the context of being lawful and crosses the line into that which is unlawful. And finally, with respect to count three, it's our position that the Doe case versus Calumet City is one in which the plaintiffs actually are supported by that case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Bailon.
Good morning. If it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Bailo. I'm here on behalf of Boone County and Ed Krieger. Your Honor, my spin on this as I was reading the brief of appellants was that they have, in essence, asked this court to grant them leave to file an amended complaint and have made reference to the fact that their amended complaint satisfied notice pleading requirements under Rule 8 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. I don't think that's quite accurate, Your Honor, because amendment would cure a notice problem, but plaintiffs have chosen throughout this litigation to stand on their facts as pled. Leave to amend has never been sought. And factually, what they've pled is not like the cases they rely on. It's not like the Boozer case.
I don't understand what you're getting at.
Well, what I'm getting at,
they lost in the district court, at least with respect to their federal claims, for legal grounds unrelated to pleading. They lost their state claims for grounds that I must confess I don't understand at all, and which you might want to address. It looked like the district court applied Illinois pleading doctrines and then decided the case on the merits against the plaintiff on the state law claims because a federal complaint would not have sufficed had it been filed in state court. Which is, if that's what the district court was doing, that's simply incoherent. Right? I don't see any pleading problem, although it may be that the pendant state law claims, the decision on the merits needs to be vacated, and this they should be sent to state court.
Your Honor, and that is exactly my point. Factually, there has been no...
Well, if that's your point, you should have confessed error.
No federal interest has been implicated by the facts as pled, and the district court, as you have stated, decided the ancillary state court claim, intentional infliction of emotional distress, on the merits, in essence, by deciding that that had not been adequately pled.
Exactly, but you don't have to plead elements in federal court.
Well, you don't have to plead...
You do in state court. Illinois is a fact-pleading jurisdiction. It follows old cold pleading rules. The federal court doesn't. And a federal complaint raising a claim under state law has to comply with federal rules, not with state rules.
And I don't disagree, Your Honor, but the amended...
And therefore, you should have confessed error in this matter.
The amended complaint does not need to plead factual elements.
You don't have to plead facts in federal court.
Exactly, Your Honor. But you do have to plead the ultimate conclusion that in a case of intentional infliction of emotional distress, there has been, number one, egregious behavior, and number two, emotional injury.
That's the code pleading approach. In federal court, you don't have to plead these things. You only have to plead your grievance.
Well, I would suggest...
That's the difference between federal and state pleading rules in this respect.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that the plaintiff in this case, or the plaintiffs in this case, refer in their brief at page 24 to Deputy Krieger's behavior, if true, as sophomoric. That's their word, not mine. We have not, and by we, I mean the County of Boone, who's not a proper defendant, by the way, and that's been conceded, It should rightfully be the Boone County Sheriff's Department, but it has not. There hasn't been anything.
Let me ask you in that regard, just as a matter of, if the sheriff alone had been named and reached a settlement, could he reach a settlement and involve county funds to pay that settlement?
If the sheriff's department settled this case, I would think that that would come out of the sheriff's department's budget as an elected official,
you know,
answerable to the...
We've been through this before.
Yes, you have, Your Honor.
That very question to the Supreme Court of Illinois. The Supreme Court of Illinois held, and we have enforced since, the rule that the county is a necessary party because the county pays.
Because the county pays, but the county would only be...
So why in the world are you telling Judge Kaney it'll be paid out of the sheriff's budget? The Supreme Court of Illinois has held that, A, the county's a necessary party, and, B, the county pays.
But the case law to which you're referring to, Your Honor, refers to the county as being a necessary purpose for purposes of satisfying judgments and settlement, not for purposes of being the proper party for Monell liability reasons. And the sheriff's department budget is the county budget. But for Monell purposes, the sheriff is an official who is answerable to the electorate, not to the Boone County Board, and as such is a distinct party for purposes of suit under a Monell theory.
Well, I interrupted you. You were talking about why, in this case, the district judge didn't weigh the evidence or required particular facts to be pled.
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to be just pragmatic here. The allegation, factually, is that Deputy Krieger has on several occasions sat in his squad car and observed plaintiffs while within his jurisdiction and on duty from his squad car in public places. That's it. It's de minimis. It's not even, it's arguably sophomoric if in fact we speculate or infer from the pleading that his intent is to cause some anxiety. It certainly is not the type of behavior that should give rise to the jurisdiction of the federal courts on constitutional levels, nor does it even put the defendants on notice of any sort of behavior which would rise to the level under Illinois law of intentional infliction of emotional distress. It just on its face can be decided. And I would argue that the district court did not have to go beyond the pleadings, did not require anything further to be pled, relied only on what was pled. The specific behavior was pled. And beyond that, in the briefs, took on behavior that occurred after the amended complaint was filed, which again was no worse than observing the plaintiffs in public places from his car. There isn't so much of an allegation that Deputy Krieger ever spoke to any of the plaintiffs, to either of the plaintiffs. And I would point out, by the way, just for clarification, the pleading is that for purposes of the associational interest claims, the pleading is that they were in a paramour relationship. I reviewed the appellant's statement of facts just moments ago. I don't think there is an allegation that they live together. I don't know if they do or they don't. So I would say that the judgment of the district court should be properly affirmed simply because the facts don't support either federal claims or a state law claim as pled, notice or otherwise. And if there are no further questions, I'll be seated.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.